You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Greetings, Fountains community, from the Angie Smith Chapel here at Oklahoma City University, where I teach Hebrew Bible for both the university and the Oklahoma City campus of St. Paul School of Theology. I'm so glad to be with you, even in this distant format, and I look forward to having a conversation with you soon. I'm grateful to your own Reverend David Felton and, of course, his associate, Jeff Proctor Murphy, for their years of collegiality and in taking a chance on my Uppity Women of the Bible Bible study videos more than 10 years ago, such that I once got stopped at a conference by someone who asked, "Hey, aren't you the Uppity Women woman?" Yep, that's me. Thanks to David and Jeff. My message today focuses on a concept I've been reflecting on for quite some time. Absurd. The absurd is an experience in which reality obliterates our expectations. An experience in which our reality obliterates our expectations, so that what we expect and what occurs do not match. Reality and expectation are disorientingly different. Absurd. This definition of absurd comes from the existentialist French philosopher Albert Camus, and it seems to me a word utterly fitting for the year we just marked, a pandemic year. Truly, we did not expect a pandemic, and it obliterated countless expectations. The expectations that were far removed from our expectations in the past year were so many and varied that it became difficult to categorize them, much less begin to grieve them. Which ones were the major losses? Were there any mundane losses? So many of these absurd losses hurt, yet they became too common even to mention. It was last year during Lent, which is itself the notably absurd season of the Christian year, when I was anxiously speeding through the grocery store, worried about germs, when I stopped at the Easter section, and that is when I broke down and cried, right there in the candy aisle, realizing there would be no gathering of friends and families and students to whom we would extend our home like we usually do. There would be no communal singing of Alleluia, at least not in the way that allowed for hugging your dear friend or wiping the joyful tear from the face of the new dad in the congregation or embracing the newest choir member. But of course, there was so much more absurd loss than the Easter that is supposed to end the absurdity of Lent. There were the grandparents who could not be with their grandchildren, not even on Christmas morning. There were weddings whose out-of-town guests had to be uninvited, where the newest form of bridal party attire was a fancy mask. Weddings that just got canceled. School became amorphous for many children, confined to a talking box in front of them, which required much sitting still, and help from parents who were themselves trying to do their own work from home, loudly whispering, "I can't help you right now. I'm in a live Zoom." Only to realize they have forgotten to mute. But of course, the most absurd is the death. The death and the death and the death. More than 500,000 persons dead just in the U.S. And then there are many millions who grieve in the wake of that absurd death. An 8-year-old boy I know who will never have another Christmas with his grandfather, and the disturbingly nagging feeling that it did not have to be this bad. Yes, this year we have experienced the absurd, quite accurately to Camus' definition, an experience in which reality obliterates our expectations. And it has just gone on and on. Well, that was a rough start to a sermon. While you're drying your tears after I so heartlessly ripped open any partially healed emotional wounds of the last year, let me explain that I began this sermon with Camus' concept of the absurd because it is my preferred translation for the theme word of the biblical book of Ecclesiastes, the Hebrew word hevel, This is the first part of your Hebrew tutorial for today. To give credit where it is due, I adopted this translation from the Bible scholar Michael V. Fox, who first proposed it back in the 1980s, based on Camus' definition. Traditionally, hevel, the theme word of Ecclesiastes, has been rendered vanity, going all the way back to the Latin translation of the 5th century. Many other translations abound, and there is some fiery back-and-forth debate among Bible scholars in the academic journals about how best to translate hevel, beyond vanity or absurd to worthless or futile or meaningless, or its most basic literal meaning, breath. At the very beginning of Ecclesiastes, we meet the individual who purportedly wrote the book, or at least the individual to whom the book refers throughout. That person is called in Hebrew Kohelet, which means something like the philosopher. That is the second part of your Hebrew tutorial for today. That term, Kohelet, translates to the Greek Ecclesiastes, hence the traditional name of the book. But I prefer to stick with the Hebrew term, Kohelet, for both author and book, as it reminds us of the book's Hebrew origin. Also, Ecclesiastes can be a bit misleading for those of us with Christian backgrounds who know that ecclesia later became linked to the church. And that surely does not fit this book, which predates the church by several centuries. While Kohelet does not have a lot in common with a certain contemporary conspiracy theory that also begins with Q, the author is a rather anonymous and mysterious sage or wise person. And I know traditionally the book is associated with King Solomon, but that idea defies all scholarly reason. The language in the book fits a much later time period than that of King Solomon. It would be like reading an Amanda Gorman poem and proposing it had been composed by Shakespeare. Furthermore, while the book itself does not exactly contain conspiracy theories, one verse in it, which has been interpreted throughout history as overwhelmingly misogynistic, one verse was a driving force behind one of history's biggest conspiracies, that being the Great Witch Hunt of the 16th through 18th centuries. The conspiracy theories that drove the Great Witch Hunt resulted in the deaths of untold thousands of mostly women, but some men as well. The verse is 7:26, if you must know, but I don't want to read it right now. It's done enough harm. And while Kohelet was not originally a conspiracy theorist, as far as I can tell, the sage and the book is most certainly full of suspicion. But I find that a good thing in this case. Kohelet's suspicion helps reveal absurdity, the harsh realities that obliterate expectations. This appears throughout the book, sometimes in obvious ways, other times in more subtle ways. Let me start with an obvious example. In 8:14, it reads, "There is a hevel that is done upon the earth. There are righteous ones who are treated according to the acts of the wicked, and there are wicked ones who are treated according to the acts of the righteous. I said, this also is hevel, absurdity." Yes, that is hevel, absurdity. If we cannot think of instances in the past year when the righteous were treated according to the acts of the wicked, and when the wicked were treated according to the acts of the righteous, well, then we were not paying very good attention. Whether we're thinking about who went to jail and who went free, whose bank accounts grew while others' meager savings were drained, who got sick and who stayed well, who got experimental medication in the hospital, and who died at home alone. This kind of hevel or absurd injustice distinctly marked this pandemic year. A less obvious example of hevel, however, comes from the beginning of Kohelet, in what our skeptical sage calls a test of pleasure, in 2:1-11. I said to myself, "Come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself." But again, this also was hevel. I said of laughter, "It is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it?" I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly until I might see what was good for mortals to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and delights of the flesh, and many concubines. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had spent in doing it. And again, all was hevel and a chasing after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So this anonymous sage of old, Qohelet, wants to find out whether life's pleasures create the good. Qohelet apparently had enough privilege that it was possible to undertake this test with a long list of luxuries: wine, houses, gardens, vineyards, irrigation systems, the best technology of the time. But the sage's list of luxuries becomes more disturbing with the mention of humans as commodities, right alongside herds of animals, including what may have been sexual slavery, though the translation of the end of verse 8 is uncertain. Please note that Qohelet's so-called test of pleasure begins and ends with hevel, absurdity. And while most of us would agree that human enslavement of all kinds goes way beyond absurdity, my concern with this passage is the way it ignores Qohelet's privilege. After all, surely the sage did not plant the vineyards, stomp the grapes, or dig the irrigation ditches. The sage's test of pleasure came at the expense of those who did the work. And finally, how offensive to refer to such luxuries as absurd when so many individuals, then and now, scramble and scrape for a basic existence. So for our anonymous philosopher, Qohelet, full of skepticism, hevel or absurdity pervades existence. In fact, the Hebrew word hevel appears 38 times in the book, both in ways that seem obvious and in ways that are more subtle. It creates, as my colleague Dr. Harold Washington has observed, the astringent nature of the book. But hevel is not Qohelet's only theme. Our anonymous ancient skeptical sage has another obsession, one that perhaps helps to soothe or at least distract from the absurdity of the book. It is seize the day, or carpe diem in Latin. That sentiment appears at least 7 times in Qohelet, including right after that verse I read from 8:14, where the righteous are treated according to the acts of the wicked. So in 8:15, Qohelet offers an effusive call to seize the day. So I commend enjoyment, Qohelet writes, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves, for this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun. Enjoyment, joy, eat, drink, be merry. In other parts of the book, like in 3:22, Qohelet's call to seize the day only gets as good as enjoy your toil, but elsewhere it includes some version of eating and drinking. And beyond the standard, obvious 7 carpe diems throughout Qohelet, there may be another one hiding in 11 verse 1. It reads, "Send out your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will get it back." This has long been deemed an obscure verse, sometimes interpreted as having to do with stewardship or even investment. But biblical archaeologists and experts in ancient Israelite life and culture, Michael Homan and Jenny Ebling, have pointed out that this verse sounds a lot like the process of ancient beer brewing, in which one began with bread, put it into water, and let the natural yeast do its work of fermentation, in which case, maybe 11:1 is one more instance of eat and drink and enjoy your toil. Now, I can't speak for you, but my experience of the pandemic has involved a fair amount of recourse to carpe diem. Find some enjoyment where we can, whether family dinners, Netflix, the baking and swift eating of pie or sourdough bread, or carry out sushi for special occasions. Or the last layer on the grocery cart, the pile of wine and beer. For some of us, that has had predictable side effects. The so-called COVID-19, meaning the 19 pounds, give or take, many of us have picked up during lockdown, due both to inactivity and stress eating and drinking. The seriousness of this is apparent in the secondary death rate of the pandemic, the losses of many more than usual to addiction, overdose, and abuse. Seize the day can go very wrong. And like Kohelet should be questioned for a test of pleasure that would have relied on the subservience of others, some of us who have found solace in the carpe diem over the past year have done so with guilt in knowing that while we eased our sorrows with the latest live stream of stand-up comedy and carryout, others were being laid off and evicted with little to no way to seize the day. This is the kind of thing I had reflected on in writing my book. Since it is a feminist commentary, one of my central questions for Kohelet has been this: can you seize the day if you had to fix the feast? Absurdity, indeed. And so, after spending a good 8 years writing a commentary about Kohelet, reflecting on Hevel and seize the day, as well as the gender issues throughout the book, I received my author copy less than a month before we would all experience lockdown, in which one of the least of my losses was of the planned celebration and signing of my new book at a local independent bookstore. And now it seems I had somehow prepared in a strange, even absurd way for this year of pandemic, which was permeated by Hevel and sprinkled with efforts to seize the day. I love that we have Kohelet, the suspicious sage who draws our attention to both absurdity and life's fleeting pleasures. I love that the ancient rabbis included this book after some significant debate in the canon, and that we can keep reflecting on it. I love how Kohelet gives us canonized permission to skeptically question what we see and hear and are taught, and that Kohelet implores us also to enjoy toil and food and drink. But Kohelet also makes me grateful for the rest of the Bible. Absurdity and joy are not enough, nor even is lament enough. I also need hope and a call to act to ensure that my joy does not come at the expense of others. So for me, seize the day is not the right salve for all of life's wounds. Me, I also need the help I found in the lines of Psalm 121, which I recently heard read to a young family during the live stream memorial service of their father. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore. In addition to seize the day, I also need the challenge and encouragement of Leviticus 19:18, which many of us Christians will recognize as a verse that Jesus adamantly quoted as one of the most important ways to live. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Yes, I need the hopefulness of the Psalms, the community found in Acts, the mercy found in Jonah, the passion found in the Song of Songs, and the transformation from bitter to sweet in Ruth. I need the frighteningly miraculous incarnation in Mark and the divine presence that persists even through death in the Gospel of John. Friends, as we grapple with life's absurdities, as we have had to do so painfully and unexpectedly in the last year, let us indeed find solace in the daily joys of life, whether in a family meal or in a distanced driveway visit. But let us guard from joy that comes at others' expense. And let us remember that seize the day does not go very far unless we also serve others and hold God in our hearts. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.